Anin, I'm Bear Dion, born and raised Southside Minneapolis. I come from a place called Little Earth. I'm 22 winters. My dad's from Turtle Mountain. My mom's from Standing Rock.
Segu, my name is Savannah. I'm also 22 winters. I'm from Oneida Nation, and I was born and raised in Southside Minneapolis.
Welcome to the Southside Minneapolis.
Southside, we outside. Welcome to our podcast.
Sage in the City, a podcast from the youth perspective in the city where we spotlight community stories, traditions, and modern day events, exploring and talking about community issues and struggles.
Where you will hear from community members themselves, a podcast under Indigenous Protectors Movement, aka IPM. So in today's episode, we're going to be talking about MMIR. This can be a sensitive topic to some people, so trigger warning. What is MMIR? Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives is an epidemic of murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. There's more to this issue than just missing and murdered. It also means what leads up to MMIR. It's also domestic abuse, rape, sexual assault, and human trafficking.
We all heard the tale of Pocahontas, right? And John Smith. Disney princess saves white man from execution and falls in love with him. Let us talk about the real story of Pocahontas and the biggest case of MMIWR. And before I get into this, I want to apologize for butchering any mispronunciation of names, because I'm not good at that. Her real name was Aminute. She also had another name, Metawaka, meaning flower between two streams. She was also the daughter of a chief named Wuhan Seneca and of the Powhatan Nation. She was about 10 to 12 years old when John Smith first entered her village. He was 27 or 28, like late 20s. And according to John Smith, his life was saved from execution by Pocahontas. That is false. He was part of a ceremony, and there wouldn't be any reason to kill someone partaken in this ceremony. Also, children weren't even allowed in this ceremony. Daughters don't have special powers over everyone just because their dad is a chief. And a chief is very different from a king. I just want y'all to know that. John Smith was known to hold villages hostage and demand supplies, holding many elders and children at gunpoint. That's ridiculous, by the way.
Being held now captive,
by the English. Pocahontas was already married, and her husband was named Kokum. They already had a child together. An Englishman named Samuel Argall thought that capturing the daughter of a chief would stop attacks by the natives. Pocahontas was living in her husband's village, and her husband's brother was the chief of this village. Argall threatened to wreak havoc on the village if the chief did not hand up Pocahontas. Upon negotiations between the two, he gave her up, thinking it would only be temporarily. She would only be gone temporarily. Before Argall left, he gave the chief a copper pot. Argall later claimed that he traded her for that pot. That's the value they see our women. Her husband Kokum was murdered by the English. This was before the ships sailed to Jamestown with Pocahontas on it. Pocahontas had to give her first child up to the women of the village before she left. In captivity, she was raped by her captors repeatedly. She was also impregnated by Ralph. From there, she's forced to marry to bring stability to her tribe and the English. She's married to a tobacco farmer named John Ralph. Ralph married her because the tribe wouldn't teach him the skills of curing tobacco. He was an outsider, but his marriage with Pocahontas legitimized him as an outsider no longer. But now he was seen as one of them. From there, she has a kid. She gets baptized and she's renamed to Rebecca, and she's Christian now. I want to say that they forced that terrible life on her, and she always wanted to come back home. She was forced to live all the way in England at this time, not long after her capture. over in England, they paraded her around as a civilized savage. Plans were eventually made, and she was finally going to be able to go back home. She was poisoned. After dinner with her husband, John Ralph and Argyll, she vomited and died. She was stated to be in good health prior to that from accounts from her sister, Mateo Chana. I don't know how to say her name. She was like 21, 22 when she died, and they literally assassinated her. I was taught the real story of Pocahontas from when I was a child. I always hated that movie, Pocahontas, and to this day, I still refuse to watch it. I don't know what the hell Disney is doing.
Although some might say the case of Pocahontas was the first case of MMIR, the actual first documented case in America took place in 1492, when Christopher Columbus first touched land in Cuba. Here, Columbus and Spanish voyagers stumbled upon the Lucayan Taino, a branch of southern indigenous Arawak tribe who had been settling there since the year 800. I also want to apologize if I mispronounce anything. I'm trying my best. The Lucayan people presented themselves as a kind-hearted race who possessed talent in farming, fishing, and craftsmanship, and lived peacefully in harmony with one another. They called themselves Lukikeri, meaning island people. Lukikeri was adapted into Lucayan by Europeans. The arrival of Columbus slowly deteriorated the peace of the Lucayan tribe as they became victims of colonization rooted in the transfer of European diseases, relocation, slaughterment of the men, and enslavement of the women. Inflicted and continual devastations eventually forced them into extinction, becoming the first and one of the most intense cases of MMIR in American history. In only 28 years, a tribe of approximately 20 to 40,000 indigenous men, women, children, babies, and elders underwent trauma and genocide so severe that they are now only a historical civilization. But to us indigenous people, we do not see the Lukikeri tribe as only a thing of the past. They are far beyond what happened to them. A group of people obtaining good intentions and welcoming hearts. They stand as a reminder to our present day indigenous communities of our loving aspects and willingness to provide hospitality. We remember the gentleness they shared and are reminded to continue our due diligences as the indigenous people of this land to carry on for the people that couldn't.
Oh.
So why should we care, you might say? Well, a quote taken from National Indigenous Women's Resource Center states that women are sacred and violence is not traditional. Women historically and presently play an important role in indigenous communities.
Unlike many other societies, especially in America's current political state, indigenous cultures include women in important roles politically, socially, agriculturally, and spiritually, and hold critical responsibility, holding either equal or higher statuses than men. Women are seen as a symbol of creation and life, with the ability to supply healing, love, and nurturement within our communities. Indigenous women are important, sacred, and deserve to be valued and respected.
Unfortunately, in today's world, we come across many cases in which our indigenous women are met with violence. A 2016 study by the National Institute of Justice found that more than 4 in 5 American Indian and Alaskan Native women, which is 84.3%, have experienced violence in their lifetime, including 56.1% who have experienced sexual violence.
55.5% have experienced physical violence by an intimate partner, 48.8% have experienced stalking, and 64.4% have experienced psychological aggression by an intimate partner. Our women face some form of domestic abuse in their lives and face the highest rates of domestic violence and abuse in the U.S.
Domestic violence includes physical, verbal, sexual, emotional, psychological, and gender violence within a family or a relationship. The roots of domestic abuse within our indigenous communities runs deep. Traumas of colonization, genocide, cultural disconnection, and present laws and policies play a role in susceptibility and exposure to domestic violence.
Historically, unresolved trauma is passed down through generations, leading to a higher risk of mental health issues such as depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, to name a few. Mental health disorders can open a pathway to the misuse of drugs and alcohol, which both stand as a huge risk factors for experiencing domestic abuse. Other risk factors include financial dependency, unresolved grief, isolation, gender inequality, lack of equality, healthcare and access, and unstable housing.
Due to lack of equal resources for Indigenous people, it becomes difficult for our community to seek help and find the necessary help essential to healthily coping with trauma and healing generational wounds. Systematic failures to provide for our First Nations has led to enforced violence and abuse among Indigenous relatives, hence why domestic abuse plays an undeniable role in the MMIR crisis. Human traffickers know who to target. They are aware of the trauma Indigenous women face coming from homes of drugs, alcohol, and/or domestic violence, leading to feelings of low self-esteem and a deep desire for love. This is where grooming comes in, promising a better life and bombarding of materialism.
White male groomers are often drawn to reservations due to the lack of legal support and protection given to human trafficking victims. Tribal governments are not allowed to arrest or prosecute non-native people, stripping tribes of sovereignty so they know the little risk there is for getting caught, making tribal lands a perfect base for illegal activity.
Traffickers find their way to reservations to sell drugs, sometimes finding women to do it for them. Then, if they owe money, they get sold out for sex. And if they refuse, our women are beaten, threatened, raped, or gang raped. Casinos on tribal lands are popular grounds for human traffickers.
In Minnesota, women are trafficked from Dakota and Ojibwe reservations to boats in the port city of Duluth and prostituted in waters of Lake Superior. Some being sold to ship crews and forced to remain on board for months at a time. Trafficking also arises during hunting season and within fracking industries, where there is a high demand for sex in a drug and alcohol infested area with little supervision. These workers use free drugs and alcohol as a lure to go party and have a good time.
Human traffickers do not put an age limit on their victims. Even Indigenous babies and children are put up for adoption or put into foster care systems where they become victims of human trafficking. Awareness and discussion on the human trafficking impact on Indigenous women and girls is restricted, and there is little support, access to services such as sexual assault exams and response team programs, along with quality education on the signs of human trafficking and ways to avoid it. With that being said, here are some signs that someone is being trafficked. Signs of physical abuse, lack of healthcare access, engagement in forced and unpaid work, inability to speak for oneself, no control over finances, malnourishment, loss of sense of time, lack of personal possessions, disconnection from family and friends, stopped attending school, sudden change in behavior, confusion resulting from mental abuse, fearful, timid, and submissive, being controlled by a person in high security measures, and living in an unsuitable condition.
Sexual violence in Indigenous communities is an epidemic, as reported by the U.S. Justice Department. Here in Minneapolis on the south side, we can see our sisters coming out of a drug haze, leaving these RVs with these men. I see them being trafficked near these encampments in an almost Stockholm Syndrome situation, where these women are women being controlled by these monsters because they're supplying them with drugs, refusing to come back home to their families.
Ways to fight human trafficking in our communities include talking about it with community and community leaders, raising awareness, hang posters, share hotlines, recognize signs, and contacting local law enforcement to identify victims and collect tips. You can report human trafficking to federal law enforcement by calling 1-866-347-2423.
Strongheart's Lifeline to Indigenous People Impacted by Domestic and Sexual Violence 24/7 nationwide call or text 1-844-762-8483 or chat online at strongheartshelpline.org.
You can also contact the Human Trafficking Hotline. The number is 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP to 233-733. And if you are a family, friend, or partner who suspects of someone who you suspect is being human trafficked, you can also reach out to these hotlines.
Murder is the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women and girls, according to the Center for Disease Control, CDC. Indigenous women experience a murder rate 10 times higher than the national average, according to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
According to the National Crime Information Center, in 2016, there was 5,712 reports of missing American Indian and Alaskan Native women and girls. Though the U.S. Department of Justice's Federal Missing Persons Database, but the National Information Clearinghouse and Resource Center for Missing, Unidentified, and Unclaimed Person Cases across the U.S., called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, only logged 116 of those cases. We are underrepresented and underserved.
Approximately 1,500 American Indians and Alaskan Native missing persons have been entered in the National Crime Information Center throughout the U.S., and approximately 2,700 cases of murder and non-negligent homicide offenses have been reported to the federal government's Uniform Crime Reporting Program. In total, BIA estimates that there are approximately 4,200 missing and murdered cases that have gone unsolved.
These statistics aren't accurate, but they're not exaggerated in the slightest. We would also like to say that there is little to no data on urban natives facing violence despite an overwhelming majority living in urban environments. So these numbers are higher. This isn't just a reservation issue. In Minnesota alone, from 2010 through 2018, 8% of all murdered women and girls in Minnesota were American Indian. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Clearinghouse data, 716 Indigenous persons went missing in Minnesota last year. Of those, 57% were women. Indigenous women make up less than 1% of Minnesota's population, but in 2024, they accounted for 10% of all missing females reported in the state. Oh, so what are the tribes and U.S. government doing about it?
In Minnesota, the Department of Public Safety, DPS, with the help of the MMIR office and countless other families and agencies, launched the Gagige Mikwendago Ziwug Reward Fund TIP program. This program aims to help advance unsolved missing and murdered Indigenous relative cases. It's an initiative that offers monetary rewards of up to $10,000. The name comes from the Ojibwe and it means they will be remembered forever. Currently, only 16 cases are available for the program. Of these 16 cases, 4 are from Minneapolis. And only one of these cases is labeled as a suspicious death. The name of this woman is Allison Lusher.
Savannah's Act was passed in October of 2020. It was a bipartisan effort to improve federal response times to missing or murdered Indigenous persons. This includes coordination among federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement agencies.
Savannah's Act. Savannah's Act was named to honor Savannah LaFontaine Graywin. She was a pregnant 22-year-old member of the Spirit Lake Nation in North Dakota who was murdered in 2017.
Pulled from Department of Justice's website, Non-Invisible Act was followed shortly after Savannah's Act. Both passed October of 2020. Non-Invisible Act is a jurisdiction advisory committee composed of law enforcement, federal partners, tribal leaders, service providers, family members of missing and murdered Indigenous individuals, and survivors. The task of the committee is to make recommendations to the Department of Justice and Department of Interior to help stop violence against Native Americans.
This includes to identify and report and respond to instances of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, MMIP, cases and human trafficking. Also recommends development of legislative and administrative changes necessary to use federal programs, properties, and resources to combat the crisis. Track and report data on MMIP and human trafficking cases.
Increasing information sharing the tribal governments on violent crimes, investigations, and other prosecutions on Indian lands. And coordinate tribal, state, federal resources to combat MMIP and human trafficking offices on Indian lands. So what are the people doing and what can you do to help?
Every year in the cities across North America, they host MMIR marches to come together and bring awareness to friends, family, and community members of MMIR. Everyone in various indigenous communities across Turtle Island knows someone that's been a victim to MMIR. Here in South Minneapolis, we have an MMIR march every year, taking place on February 14th, which is a day to spread awareness and remember the loved ones who have fallen a victim to the MMIR crisis.
Some tribes, such as Navajo Nation, are implementing anti-trafficking laws, raising community awareness and training initiatives. There is a list of missing and murdered relatives available at www.bia.gov. You can check this regularly, and if you have any info or tips that may help solve a missing or murdered case, then you can text 847411 or call 1-833-560-2067 or email ojs_mmu@bia.gov. They just ask that you be specific and submit information only once, because an investigator will be in touch with you.
The epidemic of murdered and missing Indigenous relatives hits us all close to home. It can be difficult and triggering to talk about. However, we need to keep talking about it.
If you are a victim of human trafficking, sexual violence, or domestic violence, know that there is help out there. It can be scary to reach out for help, but know that you are not alone, and these people are not here to judge you. They are here to provide safety. You are worthy, important, and capable of a better life.
Our people deserve peace, justice, and a system that we can trust. As Indigenous people, it's our job to continue fighting, spreading awareness, educating ourselves, sharing information, noticing the signs of domestic violence and human trafficking, being there for one another, and continue to talk about our relatives affected by MMIR. And right now we're going to list some domestic violence hotlines. Minnesota Day 1 Hotline, 866-223-1111. That's 4-1s. MIWRC, 612-728-2000. 2300 15th Avenue, South Minneapolis, MM55404.
There's also the National Domestic Violence Hotline. The number is 1-800-799-7233 or text START to 88788, or there is an AI chat or a live chat. And then a valid foreign protective order issued by an Indian tribe, a court in another state, or a court in Canada has the same effect and shall be enforced in the same manner as an OFP issued in the state of Minnesota.
Tribal governments proceed through with orders of protection way faster than the state government, by the way.
Okay, so now we are here with Jana, and before we get into questions, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jana Williams. My family's from Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. That's where I'm enrolled at. And I guess that's about it. I have, why we're here is because of my niece Allison Lusher, who is enrolled, or she was enrolled with Red Lake Band of Ojibwe.
So in our episode, we talk a lot about MMIR, and we just briefly mentioned Allison's case. We kind of wanted to leave that up to you to tell her story, because you know it better than we do. So do you want to just, tell her story?
Yeah, Allison was my eldest niece, my brother's daughter, and she had been a victim of domestic abuse for probably a couple of years, 2.5 years, on and off with an ex-partner, on and off boyfriend partner that she had had. Chuck Foss, and none of us really quite know whether or not he was Indigenous or nobody really knows where he was from, but Allison had, we found out that she had passed on February 22nd of 2024. And when she had passed, I had just landed in Tampa, Florida at that time. My nieces, her sisters, had called me and had just kind of said, you know, Auntie Allison died. And they kind of started telling me the story about how she had experienced all of this domestic abuse. And at that point, they had believed that this Chuck Foss had harmed her and killed her because of multiple text messages that they had been receiving days prior to her death, and just the text messages that they had received from her. And so February 22nd of 2024 is when the very first night of the fire, because obviously we all know the fire is automatically lit the first night of the passing. And there were multiple people coming over to the fire that night saying that this Chuck Foss was out in the community bragging about how he killed her, how he beat her to death, and how he tortured her. And so that was kind of like the big red flag off the bat, out of the, you know, out of the chute. And I had flown back, and at her wake, what had happened is that all of the sisters started showing me text messages from Chuck Foss, and how he was sitting outside of her apartment the day that we believe she died. So this kind of story goes, February 13th, Allison let Chuck into her apartment at about 6:30 p.m. He began beating her and choking her, strangling her. He always had a tendency to tear off all of her clothing because most victims, most women, don't want to run naked for help. And so she ran to her next door neighbors at about 6:30 p.m. in the Cameron Apartments. This caretaker and her called 911. The officers responded. They came. They showed up 6:30, whatever it was, p.m. And Chuck was GOA, gone on arrival. That's what they term it within the departments, within law enforcement. And they said, if he comes back, call us and we'll come back and we'll arrest him. But you only have until midnight on Friday to do so. Wow. Because there's a 72-hour state statute in the state of Minnesota, excluding the first 24 hours, that makes it possible for law enforcement in the whole state of Minnesota to make a probable cause arrest on a DV suspect, domestic violence suspect, excluding the first 24 hours. So from 6:30 to 11:59, that was the first 24 hours. Even if it would have happened at 11:59 or 11:45 p.m., she would have had until 11:59 p.m. That was, the clock starts at midnight. So law enforcement has 72 hours to make a probable cause arrest on a domestic abuse suspect. If it does not get sent up for charging by the city attorney or the county attorney, it is never going to get charged in the state of Minnesota. So we have got to rely upon the city attorney or the county attorney to actually send these cases up for charging, right? Or we've got to rely upon, I'm sorry, law enforcement, the law enforcement department, to send them up. And if they don't send them up, it's never going to get charged. In Allison's cases, this is what happened here in Minneapolis. So February 17th, a little bit after midnight on Friday, she got home to her apartment and she heard somebody in there. She knew it was Chuck. So she goes down to another neighbor's apartment. They call 911. The same two officers that came on Tuesday came on Friday. So they knew that he had strangled her. They knew that he had beaten her. And so we kind of ask, well, why didn't they arrest him? Why didn't they arrest him for that domestic abuse? Because that case was never sent up for charging at that point, right? And so it wasn't sitting there as an open case. And then I kind of questioned, well, why didn't they charge him with trespassing? And the reasoning is because Minneapolis PD trains their officers that if a man has anything in your apartment or in your home, not on your lease, not on your mortgage, doesn't even have to have mail getting delivered there, he has established residency.
This ridiculous.
Is, yep. This is what they train their officers in Minneapolis.
Wow. Yeah, and we also, we have the Hennepin County Medical Examiner form. They actually ruled her death as an overdose, but the cause of death on her examiner's form says subdural hematoma, which is damage to the head. So, like, in your opinion, why do you think Chief O'Hare is trying to rule it as just a drug overdose?
Well, when they found Allison, so they let that Chuck go on February 17th. They just let him go, and they said he was there picking up a few of his things, so they let him go without incident. The following day, Allison, on February 17th, her sister had messaged her at 5:09 p.m. and said, "Hey, I thought you were coming over." And Allison said, "I can't. I got home last night, and I'm too afraid to leave my apartment." So she's messaging her sister, and Nicole says, texts her back, said, "Well, I thought they were supposed to arrest him if they found him there, because you filed for an order for protection." And it was, and Allison responded, "It was never served." Allison filed for an OFP October 23rd of 2023, November 2nd, 2023, 10 days apart. And the reasoning why this happens is because Minnesota, if it doesn't get served within 10 days, it's null and void. And so law enforcement doesn't ever have to arrest you for violating that OFP. So, and then she says, Allison responds to her sister, she says that, "I'm too afraid to leave because I think he's sitting outside in a stolen vehicle. Because I ordered a pizza when the delivery driver got here, I went downstairs to get it. And he responded to her, he said, 'You're lucky that was the fucking delivery driver. If I get arrested for this, it's going to be for something good, so watch your back.'" She wound up dead that day. Yeah, it's sick, isn't it? And the sad thing is that when they found her deceased on February 22nd, what they did is they, the first officers responded, and they came out, that squad car came out, and they said to all the neighbors, this is a suspicious death. And they're like, okay. And that first officer called in crime scene. It was the supervisor after that called off crime scene. So they never took any pictures. They never collected any evidence in Allison's apartment whatsoever. The needles, when they found her, they found needles around her body. And so they deemed this an overdose. So we waited for 7 weeks for that autopsy report to come back. And that autopsy report came back that she did have fentanyl and methamphetamine in her system, but she died of a subdural hematoma. The cause of death was a subdural hematoma, which is blunt force trauma, because that is the only way that this could have happened, is blunt force trauma. There's no documentation in the world, in any medical examiner's report, any medical findings, that a normal human being could die of a subdural hematoma without having been on blood thinners. So this is how we know that Allison died of subdural hematoma and died of blunt force trauma. Never mind that what we had kind of like pushed for is like basically transparency from the department, and we got none. But we did find out that law enforcement never conducted any sort of investigation into her death whatsoever.
That is a lot, and it's really unfortunate that he's just out here, like, despite all the evidence that there is that Allison was a victim of domestic violence, they still didn't do anything. So that just shows like how many changes need to be made within our system. So what are some changes that you feel need to be made within the system regarding like our Indigenous women, and, you know, in Allison's case, like what happened to Allison?
Well, I think that this happens. This is far too common. I think that when we as American Indians, we call law enforcement, even if they do show up, they show up to arrest us, or they show up like just exactly in the case that they did in Allison, they just dismissed it. They dismissed this case completely as an overdose. They swept it under the rug and basically said, we're not going to do an investigation, because I simply think that they don't care. And I think that there's so many things that need to be changed. In Allison's case, you know, or in the state of Minnesota, that 72-hour state statute immediately needs to change. You go across the border in Wisconsin, they don't have this. They can arrest them indefinitely. So it's proven. So it's proven within Minneapolis PD. This Global Rights for Women and International Task Force was called in to investigate them from 2017 to 2022. This international task force has been to 60 or 70 countries across the world and have documented all of these third world countries that women really have no rights, right? And they stated that Minneapolis PD, you are the worst at violating victims' rights out of any department in the world. They rode along with them for 5 years. They went to court cases. They documented this for 5 years, not for 5 weeks, not 5 months, 5 years. And they said that when Minneapolis PD shows up to these cases, to domestic violence cases, and the suspect is GOA, gone on arrival, they never go look for the suspect, nor do they ever send these cases up for charging. This is Allison's case right here. This is documented. And so a lot of society, what they say to us is that they say, well, Minneapolis PD, they're, you know, they don't have enough numbers anymore. You know, and they say that they just, you know, they don't have enough cops. And so this is how we can combat this. This is documentation from 2017 to 2022, 3 years prior to defund the police, prior to George Floyd. So we can't make excuses for Minneapolis PD. This has been happening since I've been a little girl. I remember when they threw the natives in the trunk of the car and they brought them to, was it the jail or detox or whatever it was. That was a lawsuit back then when I was a little girl. They haven't changed. And all of this time.
Yeah. Do you think that Allison will ever get the justice that she deserves? Do you think that they will ever move forward with her case at all?
You know, I'm not sure. You know, the evidence is out here. The evidence is here. You know, when they found her deceased, they didn't not just close, you know, rope off the crime scene. They also didn't find her phone when they found her deceased. They never pinged her phone. They never actually pulled any of the records from her phone records. Even to this day, they still hadn't done it. So what they did is, this is documented because of these multiple protests that we've done, going in front of the city council, going in front of the CCPO committee. You know, we've done this. We've done the work on this stuff. And so finally, the city council gave Allison's case an outside audit. And so this is deemed one of the big high-profile cases in the state of Minnesota at this point. So they have this outside audit, just like Davis-Matturi has an outside audit, because Minneapolis PD failed in that case also. He had 911 calls from his neighbor, his white neighbor, that I guess he chased him around with a shovel, threatened his life. Minneapolis PD never sent those things up for charges either, just like in Allison's case, right? It wasn't until his white neighbor opened up his window and shot Davis right through the neck last October. And then it took Minneapolis PD 4 days to go in and arrest this, I think his name was John Chachek or something like that. But it took them 4 days to go in and arrest this guy.
Wow.
Yeah, and they blamed it on, you know what they blame it on? They blame it on Mary Moriarty, Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Well, let me riddle you this. If Mary Moriarty's office, if Hennepin County Attorney's Office never sees these cases like they didn't with Allison's case. They didn't with Allison's case. They didn't with Davis-Matturi's case. how could she ever possibly charge it? These cases, she can't, right? You know, there's a case out here with Allison, and we can't find it. We don't know where it's at. But this is the problem with within the department itself, right? Mm-hmm. Is that there's a case where that Chuck Foss chained her to a toilet for 3 days. And when she tried to get away from him, he stabbed her through the hands with screwdrivers, and he bit off part of her pinky. And by the time she got free of this, right, because he was a meth addict, because he'd be up for days on end, and he'd either have to fall asleep or she could possibly get away, or he'd have to go get himself some more drugs, and that's how she could get away. She finally got away after that third day. And instead of going to HCMC, because she was too afraid to go there, her niece had said, you need to get that hand looked at. She got admitted to Abbott Northwestern Hospital. They wanted to amputate her hand at that point because of this. Where are these cases at? How did Minneapolis PD fail Allison Jean Lusher? What happened here?
Yeah, so the system definitely failed her in many, many ways. It's very sad. But do you feel like the community showed up in ways that you hoped they would for Allison?
I think our first protest that we shut down the streets, Indigenous Protector Movement, you know what? They showed up. You know, there were other people in the community that showed up, that still show up. There's a lot of people that haven't, mm-hmm. that they're saying they're out here doing the work. And I don't know what work they're doing. You know, I'm saddened over the fact that we've had to do this, because I think that we believe, right? I think that we believe that if we were tortured or beaten or harmed like that, law enforcement would show up and do an investigation, not just cover it up like Chief O'Hare has done and Minneapolis PD has done. You know, they've doubled down on this case. You know, gone in front of the cameras and did the same thing like they did in George Floyd's case, where they basically are stating drugs, fentanyl use, methamphetamine use. That's exactly what they did. They spun that narrative in George Floyd's case. So they're giving that picture to the rest of society, saying, you know what, he was going to die anyways. He wasn't going to die. She wasn't gonna die. She was not gonna die. Their own medical examiner's on record stating that she did not die of this. How do we know that she didn't die of this? She didn't die of this because the drugs processed through her organs.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you were able to come on here and talk about her case though. I feel like we need to keep talking about her case because she is one of many. And although we all kind of, we know Allison for her case and what happened to her, but I wanted to ask you, like, how would you like her to be remembered despite, like, you know, because right now there's kind of a title on her, like, revolving around the case. Like, we don't actually know who was Allison. Who was she as a person?
Allison loved children. Allison loved children. Children loved Allison. You know, Allison was the sweetest badass that I knew. You know, I always knew that I could trust and her to have my back. She was a fighter. You know, she fought until her last moments here on earth. You know, American Indian women don't call 911 because we simply don't trust law enforcement. She called them. She was fighting for her life up until the last moments. And I think that's what the biggest tragedy is here. We can't talk about Allison. We can't just always say her name without saying some of these other women that have cases just like her. Alexis Ruiz Whitehawk, where they found her body in the river months after. You know, Minneapolis PD did the same thing. They didn't pull the video camera coverage in Allison's apartment building. Those records are gone forever. Same thing is with the phone records. You know, so many times what people don't know is that we have our people use track phones, right? So, you know, they don't have like Sprint for years on end. So these track phones, what happens is that they throw away those records after about 90 days. And so that's what happened in Allison's case. So now this case is sitting on Mary Moriarty's desk, right? And these investigators are looking at it. They're trying to find all of this evidence that Minneapolis PD basically threw away and just kind of like skimmed over and didn't pull, because they could have pulled subpoenas on these cases, on her phone records, on the video camera coverage around her apartment building. They could have done these things and they didn't do it. And so now this investigator is out here from Mary Moriarty's office trying to build a case enough against this guy to keep him behind bars for a very long time. But this is documented. You know, and so right now, at least in her case, we're still trying to help them. But I'm going to be honest with you, law enforcement is inept. They are inept at dealing with American Indians and how to actually investigate us. And you know, they're certainly not going to be welcomed into the community. So when you walk into our communities with your three-piece suits on, what are you doing? I mean, nobody's going to open the door, right? I mean, I wouldn't. So, you know, but we got to just continuously, you know, talk about not just her case, talk about Nevaeh Kingbird. Mm-hmm. Nevaeh Kingbird, you know what? They didn't respond to her. They didn't even start looking for her for a year after her being missing. Jeremy Jourdain, same thing. Matt Todell, you know, Damon Boyd. You know what? We have got to constantly say these names. And as a community, we've got to show up in masses. You know, we can't just show up February 14th, put our little red skirts on, our ribbon skirts on, and take selfies. You know, you're not going to see me taking a smiling selfie in front of these organizations or in these marches at these events. Because if you look at these mothers that have children that are missing, they're broken. They can never be the same without their children there. And I feel that we as a community, when this stuff happens, we need to show up in masses, because we are less than 2% of the population. Mm-hmm. We are less than 2% of the population, and I'm very grateful for those, for the activists that have stood next to me. You know, the ones in our community and the ones outside of our community. Because there's a lot of the ones that are in the LGBTQ community that have stood right next to me in front of the city council. And that Minneapolis City Council, thank God for them, because this is how Allison has that outside audit, is simply because of them. You know, I don't know if we're going to get any sort of resolve in charging with this case. I don't know, but that is the first and foremost goal, I think. You know, because if we can get this charged, then we can prove that Minneapolis PD did do this and that they're negligent in this case. And then hopefully, ultimately, we would be able to open up every other case after this and say, where did you fail these other relatives? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the change that we need. I think that's the change. And it's you guys as this younger generation. that I'm doing this for. I'm never going to get Allison back. But you know what? If we can get this transparency, maybe we can get just one slight change for your future and for your children's future. And hope to God that Minneapolis PD thinks twice next time they overlook us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate those words and everything that you do to advocate. And I also wanted to ask, what are some ways that you feel the community can show up for MMIR? And yeah, just some suggestions that you have personally.
Well, I think that when we have somebody that's missing, I think that when somebody's calling out for a search, that we show up. You know, we don't make the excuse of saying, you know what, it's my only day off. You know, I got to sit around, watch TV, or I got to go do some work in the yard. You know, there's always going to be time for that. But if this was your relative, your daughter, your sister, your niece, your nephew, your brother, you would hope to God that hundreds of our relatives show up. That's what I think. I think that we show up, and I think that we voice our opinions. I think we stand strong. We need to stand together, because we are stronger together than we are just as one. We have many voices, and we need to start using them. And as you guys, as this younger generation, we've got to stop being fearful. We've got to stop being fearful of law enforcement. And the reason why I say this is because if we didn't push this case, nobody ever would have known. Everybody else would have remained silent. And we never would have known what Minneapolis PD failed to do in her case. Use your voices. Be heard. Yell and scream every chance that you get when we see these injustices happening. You kids, all right? You're our future. And I entrust my grandchildren's future to you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. do you have any questions for her that you can think of? No. Is there anything else that you would like the audience to know or to share with us?
I don't know. I don't really think so. I think, you know, we are we're here. And I'm going to continuously stand here. I'm going to stand right in front of the police chief, call for his firing. You know, because he failed. And his department fails us daily. There are some new statistics, you guys, that are coming out here. And in Hennepin County, right? And what they are is that in front of MUD, Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors, Dr. Anthony Stately came and had these statistics from the DHS website, basically, that are new, I guess, this year, that out of all of the overdoses in Hennepin County, right? American Indian women make up 44% of the drug overdoses. We are less than 1% of the population. That is the worst statistic in the world. Not in Minnesota, in the world. We are the only population that the drug overdoses are going up, not going down. What is going on? You gotta start thinking about this. Could it be the simple fact that, did you hear about that case of Randy Rosette?
No.
Randy Rosette, July 4th of this year, was on 26th and Cedar, and he was overdosing. There was a 17-year-old girl and an 11-year-old girl that were walking by him, and they checked on him, and they realized he was overdosing. There was a Minneapolis squad car sitting right across the street. They ran over to that squad car and they asked him for Narcan, said, "We need Narcan." That officer basically responded that he was busy watching a house and he doesn't carry Narcan. they're mandated to carry Narcan. That's their policy. And then he said, you'd have to call paramedics to get it. And she said, call paramedics. He said, he can't call paramedics. He can't dispatch them. She would have to do it. Randy Rosette died that day in front of that squad car.
Ooh, I did not hear about that story. No, that is so unfortunate. Yeah, well, we really appreciate you coming on here and your knowledge that you shared with us and your advocacy. And I do want to give my condolences. Allison sounds like a very sweet and genuine soul, and I hope that we can all remember her for that. And just like sage, we don't just grow on the res.
You can always find sage in the city.